This podcast was recorded at the Blue Summit Water Conference.
Okay, so if you look at the agenda, we're going to have a session which is called Community Organizing, Paint the Town Blue. Now, we're not talking about jazz on a Sunday morning. Not at all. This is quite... What we want to do is talk about setting up a vision and of measures that we can undertake in our communities. We'll have a little bit less time for an exchange of ideas, but we'll have people here at the front who will tell us about their own vision of what the future could hold. And they will give us some things to think about in order to paint our towns and cities blue. So Mira will do this in both official languages. And I forgot to introduce myself. My name is Claude Généreux. I am the National Secretary Treasurer for the Canadian Union of Public Employees. But now back to our guests. Most importantly, we have, if you look at your agenda, we have guests. Mira Karunanantan, of course, you're one of these guests who are going to tell us about this campaign to paint the town blue. Mira? Can you introduce the other panelists and participants? Yes, I'll call Shannon Biggs.
For the next panel on community action called Paint Your Town Blue, Shannon Biggs and Steve Ogden. This is the panel on community action, and I think what I'd like to do in order to make a case for community action and this great new direction that we've taken at the Council of Canadians, our National Water Campaign, and we're working much more strongly now at the community level, I'd like to kind of highlight some of the points that were raised in other workshops to paint sort of a portrait of what's happening in Canada and why we really need to bring it back down to the community level. I often, you know, when I think about the work that I do, that we do in the National Water Campaign at the Council of Canadians, I think of the words of Mahatma Gandhi, who said that the earth provides enough to serve human need, but not enough to serve human greed. Our panelists yesterday highlighted the federal government's failure to protect water resources and to ensure water security for all peoples living in Canada. To call it a lack of leadership would be too mild. In fact, what we have in Canada is a deliberate attempt to allow for corporate greed to take precedence over human and environmental needs. Au Canada, nous n'avons pas de stratégie fédérale.
In Canada, we have no federal strategy to meet the urgent requirements and no will at the federal level to protect our water. The Federal Water Act dates back 20 years at least, and it is much too old. We are facing challenges including water contamination, lack of water, privatization, climate change that was mentioned yesterday during the mobilization on the Hill, and also efforts to export water towards the U.S. through pipelines and other means. Maud talked about privatization efforts throughout Canada.
About our groundwater resources, many of our municipalities have faced shortages, and yet we are giving bottled water corporations the permission to export vast amounts of water and ship them to other parts of the world. We are allowing, and we discussed this in the mining workshop for those who were there yesterday, we're allowing metal mining corporations to dump toxins directly into our lakes and our rivers. We're one of the few industrialized countries that allows corporations to do this. We're building, and we'll talk about this with Steve later on, we're building landfills that are leaching into groundwater resources. And the list goes on. Et le Canada, c'est une stratégie...
And in Canada, we have a strategy to open the door, to privatization. We still do not have anything at the federal level to stop bulk water exports. The Harper government is refusing to act in order to meet the requirements of communities that don't have access to drinkable water and to basic hygiene. And as Blake mentioned yesterday, we're forcing municipalities to look at private-public partnerships in order to get access to federal funds, even though there is a lot of evidence, and we talked about that during the international panel, there is a lot of evidence that P3s have a dire effect on communities and on public interest. And now we have more information about the government, the Alberta government strategy. They want to set up a market for water.
Been entrenched over the past few decades through trade agreements, which have severely undermined the authority of local governments, and Stephen Shryman will be talking about this later this afternoon. Our federal government has failed us, and while we continue to push the federal government to adopt a national water policy, it is critical that communities resist and reclaim their right to safeguard local water resources. It is the only sure way to stop an agenda that has allowed for corporate greed to take precedence over human needs, over the public interest, over the environment. And this is why the Council of Canadians, the Canadian Union of Public Employees, launched earlier this year a new project called the Blue Communities Project. The Blue Communities Project is a water commons framework for municipalities, and we see the water commons framework as the antidote to the corporate agenda that dominates policies in this country. Through our network of chapters and locals and allies in communities across the country, we are calling on local governments to recognize water as a commons by enshrining water as a human right, by banning bottled water in public spaces, and declaring their communities private-public partnership free. We have also approached more recently a number of other organizations to help expand the project and to include a water conservation component. We've invited the Ottawa Riverkeeper here in Ottawa, the Indigenous Environmental Network, and we'll be working with Eau Secours to launch a Quebec version of the project in March 2010. We've also invited Global Exchange, a wonderful organization based in California, to contribute information on the strategy that's very popular or increasingly popular in the United States called rights-based organizing. It's an organizing model that allows communities to pass laws preventing other levels of government from making decisions that harm the environment. Shannon Biggs is the director of the local green economy program at Global Exchange. She recently co-authored a book called Building the Green Economy, Success Stories from the Grassroots, and her current work focuses on assisting communities confronted by corporate harms to enact binding laws that place the rights of communities and nature above the claimed rights of corporations. So Shannon, great to have you here.
Thank you.
Tell us about rights-based organizing in the U.S. and how this concept of rights-based organizing emerged.
Sure. First of all, I'd like to just thank everybody for bringing me here. I'm not, strictly speaking, a water activist, and I'm not Canadian, so I really appreciate the opportunity to take some time at your conference. And I also want to applaud the work of the Council of Canadians and QP for really bringing this forum together and recognizing the really vital role that communities have to play in making change at the community level and moving that work and elevating that work and pushing up from the grassroots to the national level, because we really can't do it any other way. Rights-based organizing for me and my other Canadian connection is I used to work for the International Forum on Globalization, on which Maude Barlow is a board member and a great inspiration. And when I worked there, we went to WTO ministerials and United Nations conferences, and the problem seemed to me to be at the top, and that's where, for me, I wanted to focus my energy and my time. Maude Barlow took a trip to Cochabamba, which Anil spoke about yesterday, and she came back from that trip and really inspired me to understand the revolution that can happen when you really infuse the grassroots with a sense of entitlement to what is our natural inalienable rights, and then rights to water is among them. And so I left the IFG. Thanks, Maud. to go find what it was that I could do in the United States. Where was that revolution going to happen in the United States? And so I really wrote the book as a way to find out what it was. I was looking for a silver bullet. What is the best way we can organize our communities? What's the one true path that everybody should follow, and we should quit reinventing the wheel community after community? And one of the things that I found was that most of the communities, I looked at thousands of community struggles across the United States, and that was the good news, because you never hear about that in the United States, that communities are actually really struggling to get to the place where they can identify the kinds of communities they want to be. And what is standing in their way was really the focus of my research for the book. And what I found was that despite all the valiant efforts of thousands of communities across the United States, what they were really running up against wasn't really necessarily the corporation. I mean, we do a lot of corporate accountability work in the United States, and all of that stuff. But when I really started to look at a pattern, I could see that we were starting on a playing field which was not our agenda as communities. Because you're crazy if you don't start at, well, what we want. Well, we want to say no to the unwanted activity. We don't want the factory farm. We don't want the water withdrawal project. We don't want the toxic dump in our community. But we're not actually allowed to say no in our communities, because the structure of law says that we cannot. And that all we can do is to regulate it to try and make it better. And we can also chase corporations away. We can make a big enough noise in some places that sometimes we, quote unquote, win, and the community or the corporation goes next door. If it's a water withdrawal project, then they just stick the straw in the community next door and suck out the same water from next door, or Walmart moves 20 miles further down the road, or whatever it is. And to me, that wasn't really the kind of victory that I thought we were going to be able to, that we were going to need in order to change, in order to get where we needed to go. And so what was it that was standing in the way was really that it was really about the structure of law. We need to get to the place where we can actually define as communities what we want and start the playing field there. And if what we want is to say no, then that's actually where we need to start if we're really going to talk about victory. I looked at one of the most radical things that I had found in searching for community victories was a small community, rural, conservative community in Pennsylvania that passed a law that said, well, first of all, prohibited toxic sludge from entering their community. Toxic sludge had become a very big problem in Pennsylvania. Children had been dying as a result of exposure to toxic sludge, and it was leaching into groundwater and other things. And they wanted to say no to it, but the law said they could not say no. And they said, well, you know, well, then we need to change the law. And so what they decided to do was to pass a law that not only says no to the toxic sludge, but said within that municipality, corporations do not have the right to come in and use the federal constitution or state law, all of which permit toxic sludge spreading. And to say, within this municipality, we do not recognize those rights. And come after if you will, but we're actually going to just assert our right to say no to the things that we don't want and to be able to define for ourselves the kind of place that we want. I thought that was absolutely revolutionary, and I wanted to learn more. It sounded like something that we really needed to begin to work on. And so my work and my around rights-based organizing really began there. And what I really learned is that communities are absolutely willing, when they understand that the corporation is not the problem, that water withdrawal is not the problem. The problem is that we do not have the right to say no to the things we want, and we don't have the right to be able to create the kinds of places that we want. And so communities are just saying, well, then we have to, if the law is meant by and for the people, then we can change the law. And so that's what they're doing, and I find it to be a really inspiring place for me to work.
Thank you, Shannon. I'm wondering if you can... you know, because as we deal with this new project that we have at the Council of Canadians, when we take it into municipalities, it's quite daunting. And I wonder, you know, in an environment where corporations have so much power, how communities deal with the potential of being sued by corporations or with the potential of other levels of government cracking down and forcing municipalities to adhere to the contracts that have been made with corporations.
This work is the hardest work I've ever done, but it's also the most rewarding because what's inspiring is that we teach this organizing model in lots of ways when I go into a community and they say, well, why can't we, you know, we tried everything. We don't want the coal mining coming in or we don't want the water withdrawal, but we tried all the regular stuff. The regulatory law says we have to accept it. And we, you know, we wrote letters and we protested and we went to the hearings and we did all those things and nothing worked. And when they realize that the law isn't working for them, well, there are people who are willing to stand up and be Rosa Parks, which is to say that we're not going to take a seat on, you know, we're not going to take a seat on the back of the bus. We're actually going to say this is about our rights. And if we live in a democracy, then that's what we're actually going to do. History tells us that people who are willing to challenge unjust law can change the law. And it starts, Rosa Parks knew she was breaking bus company law, rules, local law, state law, and federal law that said she had to give up her seat and she wouldn't do it. So, is it easy to ask communities to be willing to stand up and, put their head in the buzzsaw of federal law, state law, corporations? Well, it is and it isn't, because you'd be surprised at the what people are actually, when they understand what the real nature of the problem is, they get really angry because the government is supposed to be for them. It's supposed to be our government. And people are actually willing to transform their single issue, whether it's about water, to the question of who decides. Who decides if I have to live next to a toxic dump? Should it be the waste management company who doesn't live here? Or should it be we, the people, who have to suffer and bear the brunt of those policies? And people actually get pretty angry and are more willing than you think to actually rise up and reclaim and claim democracy right where they live.
And I'm sure, too, there's a snowball effect, right? Once you get the first community to pass an ordinance that resists the right of a corporation to destroy the environment, then you will get other communities. I'm quite impressed by the number of communities. Do you want to tell everyone how many communities have passed?
Starting with that first community in Porter Township, Pennsylvania, Now, the work started in Pennsylvania, so the work is really deepest in Pennsylvania, but it's spread to Maine and New Hampshire and Pennsylvania, Washington State, and now California, where I live. We have 125-plus communities who have actually passed laws that subordinate corporations to local democratic control and assert their rights to make decisions about water, about mining. That's 350,000 people so far that are living under these new laws.
Unbelievable. We have a similar example in Canada with the bottled water bans. That only started about 2 years ago, and it was really hard. Our council chapter activist in Charlottetown worked on the first ban. He's also our chair, the chair of our board. It was really hard to get that first ban, but once you get the first ban, now I think we're at over 70 bans across the country in just 2 years. So really, it's once you get communities involved, other communities. You pave the way for other communities. I'm wondering if you can tell us concretely what it means to go into a community and build a plan for a community to pass an ordinance.
Right. So communities call me at Global Exchange, and usually it's, you know, the day before the, they've tried everything. We're considered the organizing of last resort. people, because, you know, oh, challenging the law, federal, state, and local law. Well, maybe we'll just try the regulatory system first, or maybe we'll just, you know, see what we can do using what we would consider traditional models. So the phone calls that I get are usually someone in a panic who's been working on a campaign, sometimes for years, or sometimes it's a new threat that's coming into the community. And I usually spend a couple of hours with them on the phone talking a little bit about this work and ask them, can I come up and talk to your community group? 20 people, whether it's a public meeting or just a small handful of people who are working on the issue. The question I ask them is, in your community, who decides if corporations can come in and pollute or extract your resources? Is it you or is it someone else? And if the answer is someone else, then the real problem is that we don't actually have democracy in the place where you live. And if you don't have it, if you don't get to make those decisions there, like, where do we have democracy? Usually starting with that conversation and really laying out, I explain what it is people are going up against right from the start. It shouldn't be a surprise to people that, yes, you could face a legal challenge, absolutely. Of course, you can face a legal challenge no matter what you do. And if you don't do this, most likely you're going to get the harm in your community. And this is actually a way of keeping the harm out, plus addressing the real structural issue that's happening. So it starts with a couple of community forums. And it really has to be something that that there's a core group of people in a community. I mean, that happens, you know, no matter what kind of organizing you do, that actually really deeply believe and understand what this work is about and are willing to begin to spread the word in their community and transform the conversation away from the single issue. The issue isn't water. The issue is who decides about your water and who should it be. And that's actually something that brings people in, because you can have a debate in your community about, well, the toxic dump or whatever, well, it might bring jobs or maybe it's not so bad or they say this or that. But when you change the conversation to simply one of who should decide about that project, everybody says, well, we should. And so it's actually something that brings people, that brings more people together in a community. And it doesn't have to be a liberal issue or a conservative issue, which is also something that's really important. It's not somebody else's agenda. It's the whole community coming together to make a decision. And that's actually empowering as well. But it's not an easy road. We draft an ordinance based on what it is that the communities want to oppose and what it is they actually want to envision for their community. Sometimes it's like they want to draft a sustainable watershed ordinance, and what does that look like? And what are the prohibitions that would come underneath that? They want to actually, you know, model what it is that they want in their community. And then it's a matter of, you know, with any campaign, how do you actually go around getting that ordinance passed? And that's about community education.
Thank you, Shannon. I could go on talking with you forever about rights-based organizing. But I will now turn to, we have a Canadian success story, a recent victory, which I'm sure many of you have heard about. We have Stephen Ogden from the community of Simcoe County, where we won, we worked with the community to prevent a landfill from being built on top of an aquifer. Stephen is a contractor in the area. I've also heard him being referred to as the godfather of the Site 41 struggle. For 25 years in a community north of Barrie, Ontario, in the area of Simcoe County, citizens have fought to stop a proposed landfill called Site 41 from being built on top of what is tested to be the purest groundwater in the world. Stephen Ogden lives a stone's throw from Site 41, and he's been a leader in that fight from the beginning. He's been a relentless leader in that fight. If you can imagine what it's like to be involved in a battle for 25 years before you actually finally see a victory. It's very difficult for me, having been involved in this struggle for the past couple of months, to actually try and summarize what it was about in a few minutes, but I'm going to try and do that. What happened 25 years ago, about 25 years ago, was that an independent committee tasked with approving the choice of the landfill actually rejected it. They called the Ministry of Environment process that selected the site fatally flawed. But what then happened was that the Ministry of Environment, through an order in council, so a decision by the cabinet, overturned the decision by the independent commission. And so they had to respect the order in council, and they went ahead and began working on the site. After 23 years of proposed designs, engineering reports, legal challenges, and political fights, construction actually began on the site in the spring of this year. At that point, Stephen and a number of other community activists, it also snowballed. So there were many, many communities in the area of Simcoe County where activists came together, and First Nations women, a group of First Nations women, started a protest camp right in front of the proposed dump site. They were there from May to September. If you can imagine what it was like, they held vigil in that campsite from May to September. It was also a beautiful example, I think, of the bridging of different groups coming together to fight the struggle across political differences. So we had conservatives and liberals and NDP supporters. We had farmers and First Nations people all coming together to do what they needed to do to protect their groundwater against this landfill. Eventually, they decided, that what they had to do was to set up a blockade. And so for a month, they had a 24-hour blockade set up in front of the site. And 18 people were arrested, as Maud mentioned yesterday, many of them seniors. And in spite of lawsuits and court injunctions, the community persisted. They were threatened with penalties of hundreds of thousands of dollars and jail sentences, and yet they persisted. And we finally saw victory after county councillors received more than 800 calls and emails. They were actually getting calls and emails from across the country when Maud brought us into the battle as the council, with the Council of Canadians, and got QP involved. So, QP Ontario was heavily involved. Deb Mink is here from QP Ontario. We managed to draw provincial and national attention to the struggle. There was national media. Ralph Nader went up and visited the site and denounced the landfill project. So this has been a significant victory in a long battle. And Stephen Ogden is here to tell us about it. We're thrilled to have Stephen here to tell us about it. Stephen, can you describe to us how this victory at Site 41 was achieved?
Well, in a word, I believe we are where we are today is because of people like yourselves. The proponents of these undertakings have money, have resources, and they have the law. But they don't have heart. And everybody here has heart. This struggle for me has been quite a struggle. To stay involved, to stay positive, and look at all the facts and try to make the facts public to everybody. We all have to know what it is we're fighting for. For me, it was the water. So regardless of all of the personal agendas that came to the forefront to fight this, always we had to bring it back to the water. And of course, democracy. And it was our community. For me, I just knew that this was a fight that we couldn't lose. So we just wouldn't. And we often heard the line, it's a done deal. It just shakes me to my bones. It's a done deal. And the proponent did a number of things to me to convince me I should not be involved in this. However, I resisted that. It would have been easy just to go home. However, that was their fatal mistake. I would go home and I'd look into my daughter's eyes. Couldn't do it. Had to go back. Had to go from house to house, making sure everybody stayed on track. And obviously, in this last year, powerful things have happened. I sat on top of a little roof in the winter, Christmas shingling, and I got a phone call in my cell, tried to get it out, and it was Dr. William Shotek. He said, "Steve, I need to talk to you. Where are you?" I says, "I'm top of a roof shingling." He says, "Could you get off the roof? I don't want you to fall off." I go, "Yeah, I'll get off the roof." So I get down there, and I got on the one side of the garage where the wind wasn't howling. He says, "You know what? I've just talked to Maud Barlow. She says she'd like to help. Would you mind if she'd give you a hand?" I thought, wow, there's a conversation. I'm getting a call from Germany to tell me somebody in Ottawa wants to help. Just help. I thought, well, in my church, they call me the happy hooker. Because I'm able to hook people. And once I got them on board, they seem to, it becomes their fight. It's theirs. They own it. And I don't have to do it anymore. So I'm able to do this. I'm able to go to people, and I'm fairly sincere, and I really mean what I say. I won't back off, and I will carry the load. I kind of see this undertaking, that's a word I learned, undertaking, and mitigate, some pretty neat words. This undertaking to be somewhat of a game. And I think the proponents play a game of rugby. And I used to play rugby. And it's down and dirty. And sometimes I'd get the ball and I could run with it. But after I got the try or the point, I gave the ball back. What a mistake. Then I would go and try and get the ball again. And that's what we've all been doing. And so when these people all came on board this year and risked their lives to be on the line, it showed that we are people with heart, and we do care about our children, and we really do need to stand up. And we are, and we will win this as long as we stick to our guns. And we have to remember that the enemy, and unfortunately the enemy is our politicians, because once they get elected, I'm sure they get lobotomies done immediately so that they can be controlled. I have no understanding of why they're willing to do this, but this is what one counselor told me one day. He walked up to me and said, "Steve, you have to have a lobotomy to be able to function in this arena." I thought, wow, that's a new word. I better look it up. So now I know it's, they're going to dick with your brain. And we can't do that. And make sure that nobody gets too close. Arm's length. Okay? You have heart. That's why you're here. You care about our children and our future. We will be the future of Canada, and we will set the example for the world.
So Site 41 is, of course, for all of us, a beautiful example of the power of community action. And I'm wondering if you can talk to us a little bit about that, Stephen, and if you would have advice for other communities fighting similar battles. You can take a minute to think about it.
In organizing the fight, we engaged all people. And by doing that, and how to do it, was we'd form groups, and then we'd raise money. And we'd raise money by the simplest of ways, garage sales, spaghetti suppers, dances, and all people would come out so they could be part of it, and they were comfortable in that atmosphere. It was a way to be to gain control of the fight. And more we did this, and we raised thousands and thousands of dollars over the years in order to continue this fight. We could never have enough money, but there was always a little bit. And then try and get close to people with influence, lawyers that had more knowledge about specific things, and then teach them to have heart. And then they would help us, and the word pro bono seemed to come along, and they might not charge quite as much as the next line. And then we'd get people who knew how to run a computer, and then a website, and all of those things. You will attract good people with a good cause. The fact is, you can't stop them from coming out. You just have to make sure that you're sincere. Always smile. I tell people, whatever you do, if you're taking on the enemy, make sure you smile. Because if you're not smiling and you're mad, you might say something inappropriate. But if you're smiling, your brain automatically says you can't say something bad when somebody says something bad to you. And so it protects you. And you're vulnerable if you say things that you really do out of madness rather than out of sanity. Remember, whatever you're trying to do is more important than your own personal agenda or how you're going to react or your madness. I'm sure I'm mad inside, but I'm not going to let you know. I'm never going to let you know that I'm furious with how our government's acting. I'm just going to say, we're just going to fix this, and we're going to do it one way or another, and we'll have to talk about that.
Thank you, Stephen. I'm wondering, too, if you can talk to us. When we got involved at the Council of Canadians and started working on this campaign, we also, we started at the provincial level. We tried to sway the provincial government to reverse its decision. And what this battle has taught us is that, you know, starting with the grassroots and putting pressure from the bottom up is really an effective way to win this sort of battle. We had no sway with the provincial government. The minister refused to meet us. The minister refused to meet with several councillors who had tried on several occasions to meet with the minister, councillors who were opposed to the landfill site. But now, recently, we have Bill 32. It's actually an old bill, but it looks like now there's some traction. Do you want to talk about Bill 32?
Bill 32, that's Garfield Dunlop, our MPP of Simcoe North, has been working with us, and I don't think they got to his brain, because he's working at this, and so we're so proud. So this bill basically shuts down Site 41 forever. Nothing can ever happen there. And that it actually copies the Adams Mine bill, which shut down the Adams Mine, Kirkland Lake landfill site. What's so powerful about this particular bill is that we have witnessed Liberals crossing the floor to vote for it, which was unprecedented and unexpected. However, we shouldn't be too surprised, or you may be surprised to know that we have a team. And before the vote was taken, over 53,000 emails were sent, reminding these people that it might be a good idea to support the bill. And afterwards, after the bill, thousands of emails were sent back out, thanking those people for voting that way. And on Monday, tomorrow, thousands will go again, asking those to reconsider their position on this vote when it goes to committee. All positive things. That's pretty powerful stuff.
We should probably explain that. So while the Simcoe County decided to establish a permanent moratorium on the landfill, that the province has issued a certificate of approval. So there is provincial permission to build a landfill on the site. So the fear has always been that a future government can then allow for the construction of a landfill on the site. And so what we're trying to do at the provincial level is to get the provincial government to revoke the certificate of approval so that a landfill will never be built on that site. And we've moved fairly far along in that process. It's gone through two readings at the provincial legislature, and it's going to committee, and we're confident now because of the amazing campaign that's been built around this issue that we will win this battle at the provincial level, which we couldn't have imagined just months ago. So a big thank you to Stephen for being here. I also wanted to point out that Deb Mink, I don't know, can you stand up, Deb Mink? Deb Mink is here from QP Ontario. She's another local hero who was deeply involved in this battle. So our time is up, but we don't have time for a Q&A, but please feel free to approach us and ask questions of Stephen on Site 41 and Deb or Shannon Biggs on rights-based organizing. I wanted to also point out, if you want to know more about the Blue Communities Project, we have guides in the hallway en anglais et en français pour vous renseigner davantage.
So you can get them out in the corridor and find out all about our Blue Communities Project. Thank you very much.
This podcast was recorded at the Blue Summit Water Conference. The Canadian Union of Public Employees and the Council of Canadians organized the summit to mark the 10th anniversary of Water Watch. The conference took place in Ottawa, November 27th to 29th, 2009.